I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source with the Indian-American pianist Vijay Iyer. I'm taking him as our sample and our guide to what's emerging in American music. In so many ways, he marks what's different in the new jazz. It starts with his having a Yale degree in physics, and at age 42, having a teaching professorship at Harvard for the rest of his life. That's a first at Harvard for a jazz artist. This is the sound of Vijay Iyer in his breakout album, Historicity. You hear the unfamiliarity of it, but it's just as striking that his performances track the practices of jazz at its most familiar. Pianist out front, setting the groove of the music, like Count Basie or Duke Ellington in the big bands of old, or Bud Powell, or Dave Brubeck, or Herbie Hancock in the small bands of recent decades. Always there's the mysterious chemistry of affiliation and the conversation with bandmates of all kinds. We're in conversation at the end of the school year in Vijay's spare Cambridge apartment. He's encouraging us in the notion that there are meanings in the sound that can be felt, if not grasped, that could almost or sometimes be translated. The hallmarks you hear in Vijay Iyer's sound include an almost aggressive experimentalism and a flair for intense and eclectic collaborations, with the one-time U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky, for example. Often with the rising star drummer Marcus Gilmore, who's still in his 20s, the grandson of the living legend Roy Haynes. Here is Vijay with the performance poet Mike Ladd.
Call all of us Homer. Homer in a top hat. Homer in a helmet. Homer in cross trainers and a flak jacket. Homer in a chair poised with the remote. Call me Still Life Commentator.
That was the poet Mike Ladd performing with Vijay Iyer off the album Still Life with Commentator. I asked Vijay Iyer, who gets to play in his band?
Well, for one thing, I just seek out people who are up for it. I guess it takes a certain amount of courage, maybe, and a certain amount of care to really be willing to rehearse, for example, and work on this music, which isn't easy. And then I also am just interested in people who have something of their own to bring to the table that's really special and unique. And
for example?
Well, Tijon Sori, the drummer who I've worked with for, I don't know, 13 years, something like that. He plays many different instruments. He's a very accomplished composer and band leader. He can do anything he wants, but what he wants to do is something you really wouldn't expect. You know, he really pushes you aesthetically, takes you on a journey that you didn't know you could go on. So he has that kind of mind and that kind of imagination, grit, a sense of purpose that is just endlessly inspiring to me. And I could tell a story like that about each person I play with.
Speak of other players who do that with you.
Well, Steve Lehman, the saxophonist, who I've also worked with for a long time, he has been very intent on arriving at his own vocabulary on the instrument as an improviser, and also pushing himself and his ensembles compositionally to present something unheard. One of his goals, I think, is to have his own personal language musically that is compatible with everything else that he's doing and with others, but is still very much unique to him. And you can tell when you hear about 3 seconds, you know it's him.
Thank you.
That's the backbone of this music, is having that kind of identifiable sonic identity.
Still challenging for most of us listeners.
You know, I find that you can actually lead audiences to a place that they don't necessarily expect. That doesn't mean it's going to push them away. If you do it with care, you know, and if you listen to them, which is what I do most intently in performance, is listen to the audience, then it can actually be a kind of bonding ritual that we all kind of go through together. It's about communication, you know? It's not about trying to push people away or present something that is going to scare them. It's about just revealing something to them that they might not have expected, but incorporating it into a larger landscape of pleasure and joy, you know? When we talk about aesthetics, we're talking about pleasure. There are different kinds of pleasure. There's the pleasure of espresso, which is bitter. There's the pleasure of a shot of whiskey. There's the pleasure of cheesecake. There's the pleasure of a grapefruit. You know? These are all pretty different. They lead the body to different places. And we can kind of assimilate all kinds of experiences like that in one day or in one meal. And somehow that's okay.
So many jazz worlds are waiting for a new direction. Younger audiences, fresh audiences in their middle age, older guys like me who heard the old timers. Where do you want to take us? And where does that band collectively want to lead us?
What did Monk famously say? You can't make jazz go anywhere. You might be going to hell for all I know. That's what he said. I find that it's sometimes useful, if only temporarily, to kind of release ourselves from the J word, as we call it. I mean, I have to say that maybe one of the most common things that is said to me after a concert, for example, is, I don't know anything about jazz, but I really like that. Or, I have never been to a jazz concert before, but I like that. What that means is that most people feel alienated from this thing that's called jazz, but they can still have an authentic experience with it. I think the main thing is just having opportunities to reach people.
Of course, we remember that a lot of the jazz world was always in protest against the word, including Duke Ellington. It always had the whorehouse connotations and racial connotations and class connotations.
Right. Duke Ellington said, well, there's only two kinds of music, good music and the other kind.
Right.
And then
right.
There's... I saw Abby Lincoln once say, you know, a lot of people today think they're playing jazz, but they're not really, because jazz doesn't exist. That's what she said. So I think if we're going to be a part of this larger fact, or the larger community, a larger history, the stream of this music, we have to be willing to accept that there is always going to be this spectrum of relationships to the word itself, and that's just part of it.
Already the young vanguard of piano jazz and small bands and the news in the music. And then all of a sudden, Harvard gave you a tenured professorship, which is news of its own kind. Are you sure the certification from Harvard doesn't get in the way of a young innovator?
Are you asking if my street cred has gone out the window?
I'm just thinking of, what if Miles Davis in his 30s had been apprenticed to the University of Harvard?
I remember my 30s. I'm 42 now. What this is some kind of collaboration between what I've been trying to do and Harvard's particular transformative moment. There's an idea that what we do as artists is of direct relevance to the production of knowledge, and that we can be in conversation with people across disciplines in philosophy and history and economics and neuroscience and design and anthropology. And what we're doing matters, I'm trying to bring that sensibility here and put it in dialogue with what else is happening here. And also continue to be out in the world doing it so that it can go both ways.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with the jazz pianist Vijay Iyer. The t-shirt I'm wearing has a periodic table of jazz printed on it. It is one jazz fan's half humorous chart of the ancestry of the music and its creators. The pianists start with Jelly Roll Morton almost a century ago, and they run through the great names like Art Tatum, Bud Powell, and Chick Corea to the newcomer, Vijay Iyer, at 42. I asked Vijay to play a little game tracing his musical ancestry.
I guess I'd start with Duke Ellington. I mean, that's a man who spanned 70 years of American music. There's a recording called Duke Ellington and Johnny Hodges Play the Blues Back to Back. Royal Garden Blues is on there. That's a good one. That's a great one. There's such a spirit on there, such buoyancy, And yeah, the way Duke comps is itself, it's so majestic. And the way he makes the music sound a certain way just in those minute choices of what to play, when to play it, with what kind of emphasis, where exactly in relation to the beat. Just very simple, subtle stuff, but it's like it makes the room change color or something like that, And it has so much lift in it. Through him, you kind of realize what swing is about It's a feeling, you know, it's a feeling that lifts you up. And you can hear it just in the way he comps. He doesn't even have to say much.
Comp as in the company.
Yeah. Well, they're both really in the pocket, but it's very rhythmic.
Take another pianist after Duke, who is in your head all the time.
Well, Monk would kind of be right after. You know, I tried to digest everything he ever recorded. He's somebody who's found some pretty striking sonorities on the instrument. And he has his own approach to rhythm that's very playful. And it's a different kind of swing, different than Duke's. Well, it's partly because of the way he plays lines, that where the rhythm lands and where the sense of swing comes from is it's just articulated a little differently. If some people hear it as straighter, it's not what I would say. It's just that it's a little more conversational, maybe.
This is Thelonious Monk at the piano in a trio on his own tune called Little Rudy Tootie from 1952.
I guess what you can hear, even from those first moments on that particular track, is that this guy has kind of generated his own personal vocabulary on the instrument. And that's pretty early in his life, that one. But then what I was going to say is that the London Collection, which is a recording from the early 70s, has the same guys on it. So to hear them playing again together some 20-something years later is pretty remarkable.
What is it we should be listening for?
I mean, what I talked about earlier in my own bandmates in terms of that sense of trust and unity that comes from that. You hear it there. You can hear it when he plays with those guys. No matter what happens, it's going to be okay. They understand each other to such a degree that it's just this beautiful depiction of how people can live together. Thank you.
What do you learn, Vijay, from the rediscovered concert Monk and Coltrane at Carnegie Hall?
Well, hearing Monk and Coltrane duo is a revelation. Mm. I mean, you hear that and you think, why isn't all music like this? Mm. It's that kind of feeling of, you know, each of them has so much to offer individually, and you can hear them hearing each other. You know, you can hear them embracing the offerings of the other. You can hear each man working with what the other is saying and building it into something. It's profound. It's like a meeting of two sages.
Dying to know what the conversation is about. I asked, Illinois Jacquette was telling me one time about the Basie rhythm section. There will never be anything like it in the world. And Basie used to come over to his house and talk all the time. And he said it was a conversation with Walter Page and Joe Jones and Freddie Green. And I said, will we ever know what they talk about? He said, of course we know what they were talking about. It was about love. It was about love of each other, love of the music, love of this moment. But it's that simple in a certain way, and yet it's also deeply mysterious, the conversation going on between Coltrane and Monk. Is there any translation possible?
Those are really pretty apt sentiments, I think, you know, to put it in terms of love, which we're usually afraid to do when we talk about this stuff, and certainly musicians are afraid to do it. Musicians are afraid to talk about it. Their own emotions are about that kind of generosity, except in abstract terms. And I think the other thing is that when we say it's a conversation, that's being employed as a metaphor. When we think linguistically about conversation, we think about the transmission of information. But that's not all that conversation is. You know, what it is first is music, which is to say it's a way of harmonizing with one another. So using the conversation metaphor for music is a little bit backwards to me, because really, music came first. That's the sound of us being together. That's what music is. Mm. So conversation is inherently musical, because it's about the harmonization with another person. It's about grooving with another person. It's about improvising. It's all those things already.
Of course, the conversation is also sometimes angry, and sometimes it's an argument. Max Roach told us one time about the recording of the Money Jungle album in which Mingus stormed out. I'm out of here. And for him, the real beauty of it was Duke the Diplomat, who sat him down outside and brought him back in. But there was a seething, maybe generational conflict going on in that music too.
Yeah, what is sort of majestic about that record is that it just sounds so true. There's not really much artifice there.
Including the tension?
Yeah. I think as an improviser, you learn how to work with things like that. That's a part of the process. And then how do you bring it to some kind of sense of resolution? Or maybe you just sort of let it persist and let that be the music.
Did you speak of some of the other, especially pianists, Chick Corea maybe, Horace Silver, Dave Brubeck, any of them, who inhabit your sort of musical head?
I think I would talk about Ahmad Jamal. I mean, one thing I like to study about him is how unhurried he is, but also how at every moment he is working. You know, so it seems like there's a lot of space, but it's not because he has nothing to say at that moment. It's because that space is discursive. You know, it's actually leading you somewhere. Then what he says to break up those spaces is very connected to what else is happening. It emerges from silence in a provocative way, in a very rhythmic way, in a very expressive way. So I suppose that dialogue with emptiness, or that dialogue with space, is profound. But it's never silence because the others are playing. So it's really about embracing the others and letting them take over for a moment. Yeah. And that's what you hear in Miles, too, who always talked about Ahmad Jamal as a big influence. But this is part of it, is that it's not silence, it's listening. It's the sound of somebody listening. And then taking action.
Some of the piano jazz and small group history of the music in the head of Vijay Iyer. As a teenager growing up in Rochester in the 1980s, he was also absorbing a lot of pop sounds. Prince, Michael Jackson, James Brown. And somewhere in the family memory, too, must have been trace elements of Carnatic rhythms and Hindu prayer songs from India. And here, in a new century, with a variety of bandmates, are some of the conversations rising out of Vijay Iyer's grown-up imagination. You can try for yourself to name the flavors of this music. Which is the espresso? Which the grapefruit? What I hear mainly is the careful listening and conversational spirit of those old masters that he immersed himself in. This is Remembrance from Tirtha. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Our guest Vijay Iyer introduced the jazz piano legend Herbie Hancock at one of six Norton lectures that Herbie gave at Harvard this past winter. I asked Vijay Iyer to open up that Herbie Hancock magic, vamping on the piano. He's defining the rhythm and the general space we're going to occupy, and then his soloists take off. Here's Wayne Shorter on tenor saxophone. Talk about Herbie Hancock. I wonder what you hear in his role in those famous huge hit recordings that will last forever.
Well, which hits? He had so many hits.
But I'm thinking of that space that he creates with Maiden Voyage or definitely Cantaloupe, which is basically just a kind of trampoline for Freddie Hubbard and Wayne Shorter, Lee Morgan, and others to bounce on and to take off on, fly to the moon from.
Some of his early work, what's called that hard bop kind of context, which is really about groove first, you know, and putting that
exactly
sort of at the center of things. He's somebody who could bring a lot to a groove or to a vamp where he could keep it alive and keep it transforming and keep it engaging. And even what he said about Maiden Voyage, that he was racking his brain for a way for it to resolve at the end. When the theme comes back after the bridge, and then he thought, well, maybe it should resolve. But then he said he had this final realization that there's something nice about it not resolving. I guess he was bold enough to just sort of let things sit like that, and then that sustains a different kind of space for dialogue or for creativity for a soloist.
Vijay, you say of volumes in those two words, groove first. And I wonder, is that part of what invites your incredible variety of co-conspirators in?
I hope it's what invites everybody in. It is a priority for me. And it's something I learned from working with Steve Coleman. You know, I was in his band for several years. We did some touring together and made some albums. Watching him in action and watching him interact and make choices and build music in the moment, I saw the power of that approach of putting rhythm at the center. The other side of it is that in my studies, academically, I learned that rhythm is first. Rhythm is just the sound of action, and we hear it as that, and it activates us before we even know we're listening to music. So it makes sense to put that at the center, because it's how we activate each other.
Vijay, you introduced Herbie Hancock at one of those Norton lectures and spoke beautifully, I thought, about what he was up to. I think I heard you speaking about what you were up to, too, but it was all about this concept of the social music, making a neighborhood that produces music, the intersubjective, non-singular voices of Herbie's music, but also of your own. And you summed it up talking about his incredible gift for collaboration, which you surely have, but it was about stepping into new spaces, initiating encounters, I mean, literally going over and talking to somebody who looks lonely or meeting somebody on the subway, cultivating creative contact. Such acts of conjuncture, you said, are calmly radical, disrupting any ideas of insurmountable difference or irreducible otherness, instead articulating an unsolitary, unfixed, and relational humanity. Is this your standard? And spell it out. What does it mean?
Well, you could say that that's my take on Herbie, but I can also say that's what I got from him, from listening to him for 30-something years. Certainly since Rocket. You know, I've been paying very close attention to him, and he's a huge influence on all of us. Many of us without even realizing it, but certainly for me, I studied his music and I continue to. I study what he does, the choices he makes, and the logic behind it, and the spirit behind it. And that's something I learned from him in the course of these lectures, just seeing him in action. He really is present for you. He's really just what we call good people. You know, which is, he didn't have to be, but he is. And I think maybe that finally has to be where it all comes from. You know, he doesn't make things easy for himself. He is constantly challenging himself. But it's because he cares. You know, it's not just a game. It's because he actually cares about people and about humanity. You know, and to understand music as coming from that place first, you know, I think we tend to think of music, especially since we've been conditioned to think as consumers, we think of music as coming to us, or as something that we access, or something we accumulate or consume, rather than something that comes from us, that is the sound of us, the sound of us doing things together, of people doing things together. You know, it's hard to really come up with a definition of what music is, but it's definitely that, first, and universally, that's what it is.
Take it into your own work. Take these little clues into your own experience, your own ambition, your own life, your own music.
I think the larger project of just connecting with people, and I don't mean connecting in a networking sort of way, but connecting in the sense of having an authentic experience that's grounded in the present with somebody, because that's where community comes from. If we make that the first priority, then rhythm comes from that priority, because that's what rhythm is. That's what groove is. It's about communicating a shared sense of pulse, which is a bonding ritual.
So I wanted to ask you Arthur Taylor's favorite question. Do you know his Notes and Tones?
Yeah, of course. One of the best books ever written on this music.
Absolutely. And he says to everybody, who do you play for? You playing for yourself? You playing for the band? You playing for the audience? And Hampton Hawes said, I play for God, man. Who do you play for?
I play for Hampton Hawes. That interview with him is a landmark. That's one of the greatest. I play for everybody in the room. And it's like I've been saying, I mean, it's a shared experience, so we're all in it together. And I try to make sure, to the best of my abilities, that somehow I account for everybody in the room, every single person. I try to make sure that somehow I reached them all. Or somehow we all reached each other. I don't know if it always works, but I try. And I think we all try.
You said it before to me that it's the drummer who basically sustains the game and frames it. And you've played with extraordinary drummers, including our friend Marcus Gilmore. Outline, if you will, sort of just what you mean about the drummer as the kind of universe. But then I want to know, what's the pianist doing? Especially when he's the leader.
Pianist is trying to keep up with the drummer. At least in my case. The pianist is a wannabe drummer. It's very hard to talk about drumming, and that's part of the reason that, like in the sphere of jazz education, as it's called, that somehow rhythm is not really talked about very clearly. But the drummers are the backbone of this music, and they're the creative force behind most of the transformations in the music.
For example?
Well, I mean, Papa Joe Jones, Max Roach, Roy Haynes, Art Blakey, Elvin Jones, you know, Philly Joe Jones, the Joneses, Tony Williams, Jack DeJohnette.
That'll do.
On and on.
And when you think of the wannabe drummers who happen to be playing the piano, who do you think of?
I call myself a wannabe drummer. When I think about pianists whose every sound is somehow a rhythmic statement or rhythmic impulse, I think of Art Tatum, I think of Earl Hines, I certainly think of Monk. You can hear him, you can hear Monk sort of sparring with the drummer when he plays, in a way that he's trying to get into the same space. Sonically, it's like a conversation with the snare drum, you know. We'll be right back.
haven't mentioned Danilo Perez and Roy Haynes. We had them in a radio conversation one time about what is the drummer saying to the pianist and the pianist to the drummer, especially in that case because Roy is so lyrical and Danilo is so percussive.
You want me to try to decode what they're saying to each other?
Yeah, please.
What they're saying is, this is who we are, and you can join us. They're saying rhythm is the central force in the universe. That's what they're saying.
Vijay Iyer, such a pleasure, and you've been so generous with your time and your learning and your history and your thinking, past, present, and future. We want to continue this conversation one day, but thank you so much for this one.
Thank you, and you know where to find me. You know where I live.
Going out on Vijay Iyer at the piano in a trio with Stefan Krump on bass and Marcus Gilmore on drums. The tune is The Star of the Story. Special thanks to the ace photographer Michael Lutch, the fine portrait of Vijay Iyer on our website, radioopensource.org. There's more Vijay on our site too, music and talk, also that periodic table of jazz, and a full playlist of the music you heard in this hour. Our conversation with Vijay Iyer was recorded and edited by Kunal Jasti. It was mixed by our WBUR engineer, George Hicks. Matt Ellison and Will Maddows, Roxbury Latin Class of 2014, are our resourceful interns. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.